Promotion Man, the true backstories of the most iconic bands in the world, told by Fred Myers and interviewed by me, L.A. Lloyd. Get involved and interact on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You'll find the links at promotion-man.com. That's promotion-man.com. Download the weekly Promotion Man podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or your favorite podcast provider.
Hey, John, it's L.A. Lloyd, and we got Fred here strapping his headphones on trying to get ready for you.
Hello, John.
Good, Fred. Well done, Fred.
I have to tell you something. Both L.A. Lloyd and I, when we got into the studio today, we both couldn't wait to talk about A Thousand Hands. What a beautiful, beautiful record.
It is.
I mean, what a beautiful piece of music.
I hate to admit, today was my first time listening to it, but I was just mesmerized, John. I mean, this is some of your best work ever, as far as I'm concerned.
And I suppose we should introduce you and let you talk. But as you can see, your music and your art has affected us, and we're kind of jaded. We've been in this business way too long, 40-some years each. But what a beautiful piece, John. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, L.A., you want to introduce John Anderson?
I do, of course. John Anderson, the vocalist of Yes. He's just released an album on July 31st called A Thousand Hands, which we're going to be talking about that album today. A lot of my favorite songs. I'm going to be a little selfish and pick some of my favorites on there, if that's okay, Fred.
Yeah, I think so, too. But what was fun is before we introduced John, we were both gushing to him about how brilliant this new piece of work is. And John, it honestly sounded to me like you really had a wonderful time creating this piece of music.
Well, it's an amazing experience to go through. I started writing most of the songs in 1990 with my friend Brian Chatton, who comes from near where I live in Lancashire in England. And he joined the Warriors, my first band, in 1966, and we became friends ever since. And he's a very good musician and a bit crazy, but that's what we should be. So we went up to Big Bear. It's a mountain area near L.A. We have a ski resort, and brought some musicians with us and rented an A-frame and just spent 2 months laughing and joking and writing all these songs. And then Brian, bless him, ran away with a girl. The wrong girl, as usual. And so, you know, he went off to work with B.B. King for a while, and I went on tour with Kitaro in 1991, and then Yes came around about 2 years later, and before I knew it, I was in that run of doing a lot of different things for 26 years until this producer, Michael Franklin, who knew Brian Chapman and had heard the songs from the mountain, and said, why don't we finish the album? I've got some money to finish the album. And I said, okay, let's do it. And he said, where's the tapes? And I said, well, I think they're in the garage. The 24-track tapes were in the garage. There were 12 of them. And I sent them to him, and he put them in the oven. You have to bake them before you can play them. And they played them straight to computer, and they sounded wonderful. And right away, Michael Franklin started, he got in touch with Ian Anderson to play on a track, and then he got Billy Cobham to play on a track, and so on. And it was like leaps and bounds over a period of 6 months. So we finished the album last year, beginning of last year, January, and there was no record company that interested, and we just waited for a good record company to come along. So we got Blue Elan, which is a boutique record company in Los Angeles, who really loved the album. So, as you say, it came out in July, this now. And the reaction is fantastic. It's interesting that, you know, music really lasts if it's good. You know, we made the music with love and fun and joyfulness and creativity. And that's what comes out of the record. It's a wonder within itself.
Well, John, this show is called Promotion Man, and I'm looking at the Promotion Man, Fred Myers, going, what the hell is wrong with the record industry in 2020?
I know.
I mean, how can you not want to pick up this music?
And you know what you had said when you were in Big Bear doing this in an A-frame and laughing and having fun? You can feel that in the music because... Yeah. When I knew that we had an opportunity to talk to you, I put on my headphones and just kind of went with the album. And I found, like, Firstborn Leaders, that track's got a really great Caribbean kind of groove to it, which was really light and sweet.
Yeah.
Firstborn Leaders, it was just a cool track.
I got to tell you, one of my favorites, I mean, the musical journey for me was when I played Activate, John. I mean, that's it just takes you all over the place. It's brilliant.
And it's got Ian Anderson playing a flute.
Right.
Beautiful.
Yeah, actually, when I was down there in L.A. in 1990, Chris Squire was in L.A. with Alan White. They were doing a record with somebody. So I went down with the tape, and I got him to play on Activate Me and a couple of other songs. So the last person who actually played on the album was Steve Howe. He played on the last song.
Wow.
Which was last Christmas.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So, I'm sorry.
These wonderful musicians on the record. It sounds fantastic. You know, when we put Billy Cobham on 1,000 Hands Come Up, and then we had Chick Corea, and I couldn't believe this guy. And, of course, I'd just been touring with Jean-Luc Ponty, so I got Jean-Luc Ponty to play on that track. And these are really incredibly talented people, so it blossoms.
No doubt about it. Absolutely. And Thousand Hands, the title track, is just beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely a beautiful, beautiful piece of work.
Well, I'll tell you, when I played that song at the very end, John, I was clapping along with you, man. I could not resist. I had to clap with that one, man. That's a good one.
So, John, I want to go back a little bit into the Yes days because I want to share a story with you. The Fragile tour that came to Michigan and Detroit, where I grew up, was the very first big arena show I had ever seen. And there was a girl I had my eye on in high school, and I was kind of walking all of them to class, quite frankly. I just wanted them all.
Right.
No one said you couldn't have them all.
Nothing's changed since high school, it seems.
But in this particular case, she bought two tickets to the show and asked if I wanted to go, and I had to borrow my grandmother's 1966 Impala.
Nice.
That had the bench seat.
Right.
So she could scoot close to me.
Yeah.
And it was then I ended up marrying her. And I'll never forget that tour because from the minute the house lights dropped and the band went on, it was the most amazing musical journey. And that's the thing that I think you and your art conveys because, you know, Rick Wakeman kind of looks like a wizard up there. I mean, he's got this ridiculously amazing keyboard setup, his hair. You know, there is this British culture and this British vibe from the band that's so intricate and so complex and yet so beautiful in all the textures that you guys produce. So I just wanted to share with you that was my very first arena show, and the one I followed it up with was this band called Pink Floyd, and they had this Dark Side of the Moon album they were releasing.
Wow.
So those are my back-to-back arena tours when I was, in high school.
I won't even try to one-up you on that one. I don't think I could. But, John, we love it. You know, John, I was just kind of curious. I mean, the sound on the album is so amazing, all your albums. But when it came to the live performance, I mean, were you really like, one of these guys who would be really very particular about every ambience of sound that came out during the live show? Because a lot of times some of these albums that some bands do, they just can't pull it off live. You guys could. I was just wondering how meticulous you were setting up the stage and the lights.
Well, they used to call me Napoleon.
There's your answer.
I like it.
Yeah, I remembered in the early days of watching bands, and especially when we started doing 5,000-seaters and 10,000-seaters, the people in the back, they deserve a big visual show. So I was always very, very, using laser beams before anybody else tried it.
Mm-hmm.
And with the band, everybody in the band was so, what you might say, they wanted to play great. They just begged to play great. And if anybody messed around on stage, everybody would look at him and say, get your act together or you're out.
Wow.
You know, yeah, because the music was propelling us forward by Fragile, the album Fragile. We'd made three albums, and then Fragile came out, and that became a success around the world. And all of a sudden, even before that, we were very, very professional about making good music on stage, making it sound great, and just perseverance, you know?
That's very cool, man. I kind of expected that, you know. And then you mentioned Fragile. I mean, what a life-changing album that was for you. I mean, was it a little overwhelming at first? Because, I mean, it was just, you know, every friend I went to, they always had this album. And like you said, it was a worldwide success. Did it really change your whole outlook on the music industry and being in a band when this one really took off the way it did?
Well, it kind of scares you to death because you wonder, what's the next step?
Yeah.
I started thinking, I want to do something a little bit more. See, in Fragile, we had four tracks that were the main tracks, Starship Trooper, Heart of the Sunrise, and so on. And these were 8, 7, 8, 9 minute, Roundabout was a 9 minute piece, and then it was cut in half to make it into a single, which is okay, and it really worked. But I was more interested in a 15-minute, 17-minute musical extravaganza, and that's what moved the band into Close to the Edge. And that's really when we realized we were doing something very musically adventurous, very different, nothing to do with the pop radio or whatever. It was just music, and that's what galvanized that year. It was only 1 year. We did Fragile and Close to the Edge in 1 year, and we toured. Mm. So we were excited, and we just kept playing and keep going, guys. Keep going. Come on, we gotta move on and get on with some better music, you know?
Yeah.
Well, John, it's great that you say that, because this show is called Promotion Man because I started with Warner Brother Records as a promotion man in 1978. And prior to that, L.A. Lloyd and I on this podcast, and now we have a radio show, we've told our listeners that back in the late 60s, early 70s, FM radio became an outlet for rock, and it was not uncommon to have 6, 7, 8 minute songs, which is why I think the Fragile album really broke as big as it did, is because it had that outlet of FM rock radio, which was really in its infancy. It was only a couple of years old. And then, of course, Top 40 wants to take it, shorten it, make it tight, and make it into the top 40, which is what they were all about for that format. So it's interesting that you had said that, because when I revisited the albums last night, you know, it was pretty common to see almost every song being over 6 minutes long.
Yeah.
But like what L.A. Lloyd had said, you know, you'd go to someone's house and you'd hear Roundabout, you'd hear, you know.
I've seen All Good People.
Yeah.
It's everywhere.
And here I am in a garage band, and we're trying to duplicate this as, you know, so we can play it at parties. And it was like impossible.
Good luck.
Yeah, it was impossible.
Wow.
Yeah, we really didn't think about anything but being creative. And when the juices start, you know, you start rehearsing a song like Long Distance Runaround, you know, and basically it was just a song with me on guitar, that's three chords, and so Steve started playing the guitar, and then Rick started playing the keyboard and the bass, and they're all playing the same chords. And I said, wait a minute, guys, no, basically what we need to do with this is empty it out. Just get Rick to just play the chords like dun 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 dun, and then you guys can go dun 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 da 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 da. I was thinking Stravinsky, so da 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 da. You know, and they started learning that, and I left them that for about 2 hours, and they finished the whole song, and all of a sudden it became this monumental idea that people would say, "How do you play that?" And actually, it was just like Bill Bruford said one time. He said, being in Yes is like being in school. You learn the times table, and you never forget it. And so you'd learn this riff from that riff, put it together as a song, and you never forget that. And then people would sort of say, how did they do that? Well, you learn that thing, that you learn that riff, and you learn that style, and you learn that part. And it really motivated the band in Starship Trooper, especially part of the Sunrise, where Chris and Bill Bruford were playing this for about an hour. And I said, guys, why don't you change key?
That's so great. So share with our listeners how, you know, kind of walk us through, how did Starship Trooper come about?
It's so damn funny because I wrote the song, and it was one of those songs that sort of came together in an afternoon. You know, because I had this idea of sliding the E chord, sliding it up the guitar. So Chris, brilliant guy, you know, melodic, and then double it with guitar, and then Rick Wakeman with the colors and everything. And there was about three different parts of that song that I'd written, and by the time we'd learned the first part, they looked at me and said, so what's next? And I went, oh yeah, speak to me all summer long, winter's longer than time, and on guitar. And I said, can we just have Steve doing it like a country song or something? And Steve would just do it like that. And that's how you actually, within an afternoon, you'd actually put together this track. And then it was about probably around 7 or 8 o'clock. We'd had some dinner, and then we started listening to it on the tape and everything. And we just said, we need an ending. And Steve, bless him, came up with these four chords, which are dun 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 dun, key chords. And he started playing that. And then the band just automatically built it up. And that's how we finished that night. We'd actually put that song together in one day, basically.
So that's incredible. I mean, because it's such a global hit and it means so much to so many people. So when you had heard the final mix after everything has been done and you guys are sitting around in the studio listening to the final mix, did you just have this huge smile on your face?
Well, we just had a big joint and
yes. My kind of guy.
So, you know, The great thing about Yes moving into the 80s is kind of when I got into radio. I was in college radio beginning in 1980, and then all of a sudden this little thing called MTV comes along, and it really did change careers for some established bands and, of course, broke a lot of new bands. Owner of a Lonely Heart was on there all the time, nonstop. But I wanted to ask you about an April Fool's prank that MTV did back in 84 with the follow-up to Leave It. Martha Quinn comes on, and she starts playing the big premiere of the video. And, you know, there was one video they played back-to-back. It was all the members on there. Then the next video, you'd have your back to the camera. And then there would be maybe one member not in the video, and then only one member in the video. And they just did this all day long. And I was just wondering if that was them behind that or something you guys kind of brought up.
I think it was Chris who said, you know, let's not just stand there and pretend to play. Can you not do something with the tape? And, you know, I'll have a different tie on. And then and all of a sudden they have this falling down thing. And I said, this is the best ever video in my life.
Oh, that's why now that we talk about A Thousand Hands, it's clear that you just have so much fun and it really transpires through the music. And it's such a pleasure to listen to that album. And we encourage all our, following on the podcast globally to go check out A Thousand Hands. And certainly when we do our radio show, we'd like to play some of that well.
For sure. So, John, I mean, obviously we got a pandemic going on, if you haven't heard about that, just in case you're wondering. But, you know, everyone's looking forward to 2021, getting back on the road. Every band, no matter what place they are in their career, is just, you know, wanting to get back on the road. So you've got these great songs that just came out, you know, just a couple of months ago. Are you going to be able to go out there and tour some of these songs?
Well, actually, last year we toured. Where are you located? Are you in Boston or somewhere?
We're in Austin, Texas.
Austin, Texas.
Yes.
We played there. I played there with my 1,000 hands band, Austin, Texas, in Music City. And we played there. I can't remember where we played, but we did 2 months at the beginning of last year and then 2 months around August, September.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just going around America with this wonderful, wonderful band of musicians out of Orlando. Some great musicians. And they were. We had a violin player from Taiwan. We had a keyboard player who played banjo and trombone from Thailand.
Wow.
We had a bass player from Ireland. We had a drummer who's my great friend drummer from L.A. and a percussionist from Trinidad. It was like a multi-international band, and everybody loved singing. And we did one track. In fact, I'll send it to you. It's Come Up, which goes into Starship Trooper.
Oh, nice.
We started the show with On the Lonely Heart, Yours is No Disgrace, and Heart of the Sunrise, and kept going. No, the Sun threw in songs from 1,000 Hands. So we had a two-hour show, and people loved it.
Yeah.
So we talked about touring right now. We were supposed to be on tour in October this year and to promote the album because it was going to be released. So we talked about it about a month ago and said, well, next spring, you know, everybody will be going out. So what are we going to do? And I said, well, let's wait and see, because I think if everybody's going out next spring, it's going to be hard to get the right gig. You want to get the right gig. But then the whole thing was, what happens if we can get the album to get into, get a Grammy nomination or something like that? And I said, well, that's enough after the gods. You never know.
Yeah.
Right. So what I did, I had this one song, because there was about four songs left over from the album that we never released. There was one of them called Go Screw Yourself. I don't know if you've seen it or heard it.
I'd like to.
I'll send you a copy. I'll get Ryan to send it to you, because I put it on my Facebook, and I can't believe 150,000 people have checked into it, and some don't like me because I swear a lot.
You know, that's funny.
It's a song about, you know, what we all know, politicians are bullshitters.
Right, and they are.
A lot of priests and religious people are bullshitters. They're going to sell you heaven for money.
Yes.
And, you know, Wall Street is not trustworthy. And a lot of things are not really good. So they screw us, you see. And the chorus is, well, go and screw yourself.
I think I might can use that every time I get pissed off at Fred from here on out. So hey. Drop that little snippet in there for me, Chewy.
We rarely fight. Hey, John, I wanted to come back to Yes again, because you've had so many hit songs. I mean, it's been such a wonderful array of hits, and they all mean a lot to people. But there's one song in particular I wanted to focus on a little bit is I've Seen All Good People. Can you kind of tell us how that played out, how that came about?
Yeah. I'm just sending a screw to you now.
Okay. Oh, okay. Great. Thank you.
Just for you.
Okay. So, All Good People. I remember I was singing the song when I first wrote it on my guitar. And Steve came in, and he just bought this beautiful there's a guitar from Portugal, 10-string sounding, beautiful sounding guitar. So we started playing the song with that. And then the guys in the band started playing, and I just said, no, guys, think of your heartbeat. Do, 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 do. Steve got that one. Da, 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 da. And it's like a heartbeat. Boom, 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 like that. And Chris was doing that boom, boom. And he got that feeling. It was a kind of magical sound. And so we did a recording of it. Because it's time, it's time, and time, and time with your time. And it's this capture for the queen to you. And then we did about three or four verses, and then I just said, okay, we're still kind of mellow sound-wise. Chris is just developing a bass line. I said, what we need to do is after the cut is time and time and time and time and time, we'll come in like a big Gothic organ, like a big church organ. Mm. And Nick said, yeah, I've got one of them. And of course he did.
Of course he does.
Yeah. And then I remembered the day before, Chris and Steve were doing this riff. For about an hour, like they would do. And I'd say, okay, change the key. So, and I'd start singing, something, you know. So we had a tape of it from the day before. And I said, so at the end of this song, why don't we just do it like a drum roll? The second half of the song is the riff. And they all looked at me and said, okay, John. So we did it. Again, it took a couple of days to finish that song. And right in the middle of the church organ, I started thinking of John Lennon. About,
oh wow,
you know, give peace a chance. So we started singing it in the background, you know, just because I sang a part of the song was take an instant karma to me and something, something, something. And I thought, instant karma, that's so John Lennon, you know, and that's why it happened.
Beautiful song.
Well, you know, you mentioned that when you did some touring, the first song you kicked off with was Owner of a Lonely Heart. I mean, you come right out swinging with that one. Obviously, it's a huge fan favorite. And no one can predict the success of any song, a single or anything like that. But did you even have to step back a little bit and go like, wow, this song did even better than anyone's expectations?
Well, it's a funny story because I was in the south of France. Having a break and living down there, I was writing some music about this wonderful artist that I met who came from Russia. His name is Marc Chagall. And he was 90 years old when I met him. So I started writing songs to him, and I'd go to his house and sing to him, you know?
That's so great. What a great story.
He's still painting and everything. This is 1977. And so 1978 comes along, and I'm sorry, it's 1980. I got my dates wrong. Edit. And so I came to London for a break, and Chris called me up and said he'd be working with Trevor Horn, who was one of the really hip producers of that time. He'd worked with Malcolm McLaren on an album called Duck Rock, which was very, very good. And basically, he'd met up with this guy, Trevor Rabin. So he came to my house. I got into his Rolls Royce, as you do. And he played the tapes of the recording. And one of them was Owner of a Lonely Heart. And I said, oh, man, this is one of the greatest recordings I've ever heard. This is seriously good. The verses aren't that good. The chorus is a hit. It's obviously a big hit. You could tell. So Chris said, well, would you come in tomorrow and sing the verses, please? And I said, well, obviously, if I come in and sing on this record, it's going to be yes. And he said, that's what we want. And I said, oh, okay. So I went in, and the first thing I realized, that the verses were very melodic. Going along rather than being opposite to it. So I said, I think you need a staccato sort of song like da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's Mastrovinsky again, see? And Chuck said, okay, what did you just sing? I said, I can't remember. And we listened to the tape, and it was I was trying to listen to it and say, move yourself. You will always live your life, never thinking of the future.
God, that's so great.
Move yourself. You know, you start putting it together because you can kind of hear what I'm trying to sing.
Yeah.
And then I sing, you know, you've got to believe in yourself or you'll be an owner of a lonely heart. And wow. They all looked at me and said, true, man. You know. So the record company already said, this is going to be worldwide. This is, and actually, yeah, it's like La Bamba.
That's yeah. No question. Well, thank you so much for being a part of the Promotion Man podcast and the Promotion Man radio show.
Yeah.
I'd like to finish with you going over the new album, kind of reading the guest of musicians you have on this album, because I want people to go to iTunes and download it, because it's just a beautiful, beautiful piece of music. And I definitely downloaded it yesterday. I've already listened to it about 4 times. I've gravitated to my favorite songs. But what a beautiful piece of work, John. Thank you.
I appreciate your agreeing with me.
So tell everybody who are your guest musicians on A Thousand Hands, your latest release.
I remember Chick Corea, Billy Cobham, Ian Anderson, Jean-Luc Ponty, these wonderful singers from Belgium called Zap Mama.
Zap Mama.
Yeah, they're incredible. I met them in 1991, and I wanted the Beach Boys to sing on this record, but I went out and get them to sing on Chapter 2, actually, because I got friendly with them. There's Tower of Power, incredible.
Yep.
And, of course, there's so many different musicians on it. I'm looking at my webpage now, trying to find anything that says anything about anything.
Well, you've got Chris Squires, Alan White, Steve Howe.
Of course.
Yeah.
Chris Squire, Alan White played at the beginning of the record, and Steve Howe played at the end of the record. So it's just an amazing overall. The funny thing was that Michael Franklin, the producer, he used to be on tour a lot with his brother, with Chuck Berry, for 15 years of his career.
Wow.
He met everybody. So he knew all these people. And most of them, I knew the names, but I didn't know them personally. And he just got them coming in and coming out, going in and coming out. And have you got a list of them there?
No, I don't have a list of them there, but I did, you know, but the bottom line is everyone you had mentioned, Ian Anderson from Jethro Tull, Billy Cobham, Jean-Luc Ponty, Steve Morris, Chick Corea, Zap Mama, Chris Squire, Alan White, Steve Howe, what an array of musicians, which is why these listeners, you know, you guys need to download this album. It's a beautiful piece of work.
You know, Fred, I think you know when you've arrived that you have so many guest musicians on your album, you have to actually go back to the vinyl and look at the credits to see who played with you.
Yeah, I know.
That's amazing, man. That's a great story, John.
John, thank you. This has been a wonderful, wonderful opportunity to visit with you, and thank you for your time today.
Yeah.
My pleasure. Your video just arrived, so watch the video, and have fun.
I'm going to smoke a fatty and watch it.
Take care, guys.
All right, John.
Bye, John.
Thank you.